listen to a story about the festive fans. Two old friends dreaming about the foreign lands. And then one day they were thinking it'd be cool to find how the world is a celebrating you. Christmas! Noel! Nativity! Said it's time for a podcast. Said a Christmas movie is what you ought to see. So they scouted across the globe for one in each country. Far away, overseas, distant lands. Time to start the show with Bob and Mark and Jake. We'd also like to thank you folks for all the time you make. You lend your ears to listen to us every other week, to spend a festive episode with other Christmas freaks. 3 years anniversary show! Y'all come back now, you hear.
Previously on the Festive Foreign Film Fans, the boys traveled through history. They signed the Declaration of Independence. They survived the Civil War. They narrowly escaped the stock market crash of 1929. They handed out 3 prestigious 4F awards.
And their wives disappeared under questionable circumstances.
Oh my!
But the adventure is far from over. Join us now as we continue our journey through history to celebrate 250 glorious and messy years of American spirit. Plus, we still don't know which foreign location will emerge as our favorite festive country of season 3, and which of the many Christmas movies we watched this year will claim the best of crown. Welcome to part 2.
Cue the fireworks, light up the tree, fire up the grill, and turn up the Christmas music. It is time for the Festive Foreign Film Fans' 3rd Anniversary Spectacular, featuring a festive face-off of holiday heavyweights, wrapped up in red, white, and blue. From the heart of Cary, Illinois, our annual 4F event is back, and this year we are bigger, louder, and more patriotic than ever before, as we also salute the 250th birthday of the United States of America. So rally the troops, down the nog, and raise the flag. It's going to be a star-spangled celebration and one unforgettable great American Christmas clash, an ultimate holiday smackdown. Are you ready?
Have you ever seen any of those foreign films? I don't like them.
Lord, you! Christmas last forever.
Some are born great, others achieve greatness, and some watch Christmas movies.
For Natal!
We are the wild and pretty guys.
Well, they're both festive, aren't they?
Joyeux Noël!
Mark, asking me to choose my favorite country is like asking me to choose my favorite child.
Oh, I know, Bob.
I mean, what do I tell the other two?
You know, you're officially supposed to say that you love them all equally.
Yes, but unofficially, who gives me the better gifts?
Bob, these are just countries. It shouldn't be such a big deal.
Are you kidding me? They all act like spoiled children. All I ever hear about is, how come you never come visit? How come you like the bigger one, the richer one, the one that's more attractive? I even hear that old, look at me, look at my art, look what I did for civilization. And I just want to say, look, I love all you countries equally, and then change the subject.
But that won't work, Bob, because this is an award show. You need to present your three favorites.
Great. I may be a little busy during season four, spending the rest of the year apologizing to the other 194. But anyway, here we go. Mark, in the same way that you picked the custom from a country that we love for its cheerfulness, its embrace of Christmas, and the movie and the music and the food and everything, my third choice is the Philippines. I loved everything about that whole episode.
Great choice. All the things you said. And like I said, every Filipino I've ever met personally or up close to, they're always just a positive disposition and an outlook on things. So, well, that's a really good one. Well, my number three is England. They obviously made my first cut. I mean, my second cut. But if you think about, I think, one, the close relationship we've always had with that country. Two, how we've broken away from that country and they're still our friends. And just so many of our traditions and sayings. And I really enjoyed when we talked about England and the movies from there. So I chose England as my number three favorite country.
You know, it's kind of unfair because I would almost say I didn't give it a fair shake and I kind of almost shrugged it off. But if you think about it, what you just said, we had so much material. We filled two shows. And because so much of the history, so much of the traditions, there's so much really there to focus. I mean, we had three movies, right?
Right.
Three movies, and Jack brought up another one, Nativity, that easily could have been a fourth movie. God. You know,
so funny. Well, I just closed my eyes and thought of England.
Of course you did. Well, my number two probably will surprise you just based on the movie, because I wasn't necessarily motivated by the movie. I was motivated by the country,
yeah,
the beauty, the culture. I picked Switzerland. Switzerland was my number two.
Bob, they eat cats and dogs. They're eating the dogs. Oh, they're Mark, eating the cats.
That's just in the rural area. You know, you're not having the fondue in the city and they're serving you dog and cat meat, I hope.
Yeah.
I just kept thinking of those mountains, those beautiful mountains.
Yeah, it's hard not to love them. Well, it didn't make my three, but I could understand why. And, you know, it's the criteria that Bob and I used for picking the best country, we answered a 17-point questionnaire, and then we divided it by 13, multiplied it by 952, and that's how we got our answer. I mean, there was no magic to it. I was like, movies and then customs. And so,
you know what pushed it over the edge?
What?
The Last Christmas video by Wham is filmed in Switzerland. That just edged it ahead of the other ones.
Yeah. That movie, while not great, it was really nice, though, how we corresponded with the writer, the actor.
Yes. We never talked about that on our show, but yes.
We did it.
The actor in the movie reached out to us, and he listened to the podcast.
He did. Remember, because we were both questioning some things about it, that whole thing with the main character in the church. And maybe now I'm feeling bad. Maybe I should have made him in my top three. But guess what? They didn't make it. Stop eating cats and dogs. Well, my number two, for kind of similar reasons, maybe. I love these small countries. Someday, God willing, I just want to spend 3 or 4 months and go to all of these little countries, right? Luxembourg is my number two country.
Oh, wow. I never would have picked that for you, Mark.
I think it was a lot of it had to do with the traditions they had.
Yeah.
And it's a small country, and it's one of those very strong small countries. And so I picked Luxembourg as my second favorite country.
I'd love to be shocked. That's great. I never would have thought Luxembourg wasn't even near my list. So that's awesome. Well, my number one, and I guess the movie did play into helping with my decision and kind of along the lines of what you said, wanting to go to some of the smaller countries. I picked Estonia, and it was how they were embraced nature, and that movie covered the nature so well. And then some of the traditions, the beauty of it. The movie was so refreshing. Our song was by the girl who starred in the movie. It was all great. And
which
I picked
Estonia. That's a really good one. My number one country, it wasn't Alaska, USA. It wasn't Switzerland. It was Belgium. Belgium was my number one country. A little bit influenced by the movie, certainly influenced by their traditions. And again, another small, strong country. I love these small, strong countries who have these incredible economies, incredible people who are on the happy scale. Let's face it, I am influenced by the fact of the Christmas beers from Belgium. But all the country I think we've mentioned are places I would love to go. We could totally do a fly into England, go to Belgium and Luxembourg, go to Estonia.
I love that idea. Mark, so this is Belgium. It's come in three categories of yours.
Yeah.
I'm stunned. And somehow my brain is turning like this might become the pierogi of next year. Do we really dive deep into Belgium? Maybe. So interesting. I don't know.
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, Silent Bites came out of nowhere. So I don't even know what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, let alone what's going to happen a year from now.
Well, I have to just tell you, you did a great job because I never would have saw either Luxembourg or Belgium coming. That's great.
They're just like me, strong, small people who drink beer.
Rich.
Well, two out of three ain't bad. Hey, Bob, hey, why is this kiddie pool smoking?
Mark, that's how we know that it's working.
No, it doesn't. I've been through three quantum leaps with you without any flames.
Oh, no worries. It's just a temporal combustion.
The temporary what? Combustion?
Yeah, it just means that the science is working.
Science? The closest you've ever been to science is testing milk to see if it's spoiled.
Hey, but I will need you to get out and give us a push start.
What?
Well, I have to drive. You think I'm sitting here holding this pool noodle just to get a suntan? Now on three, you got to shove.
Where are we even trying to go?
Anywhere before this thing explodes.
Wait, what?
Three!
Cannonball! Oh my God, look at me.
What's wrong?
My clothes. What the heck? Red and white checkered shirt, jeans rolled up, penny loafers?
I know. You look pretty keen.
I don't want to be keen. I want to be cool. If we had to go back to the 1950s, I thought I'd be more of a leather jacket guy with a white t-shirt. You know, Marlboro Reds rolled up into my sleeve, or at least the candy ones. Come on, dude. I want to be more James Dean and less Howdy Doody.
You know, the strange thing is, though, we're still ourselves. We aren't historical figures. Now, that's different. It must be the stalled time displacement.
Are you making this stuff up? And how come you get to wear the uniform, shirt, heel boots, and the pomodoro?
I know. Neato, right?
Neato. Why do you think we're here? Do you think it's to witness the birth of rock and roll? I read...
Red?
Yes, you know, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, sexual verses.
Subversives?
The absolute legends are young and alive here. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley. You think we'll get to associate?
A Soviet?
Let's go find them. I want to rush things along.
Russian?
Why do you keep repeating what I'm saying?
Are you a commie sympathizer?
Wait, what? It's me, Mark. From the future, just like you.
You know, that's exactly what a communist would say.
Bob, we literally just traveled together through time in a radioactive kiddie pool.
Oh, classic cover story. Think about it. Your obsession with music of a questionable origin raises questions about your loyalty to the American way of life. Why do you encourage loud music? Why do you oppose traditional haircuts? Why do you promote juvenile delinquency, racial mixing, youth rebellion, emotional outbursts, and those foreign rhythms? This is communist infiltration.
It must be the stalled time displacement. You somehow got crossed up with the Red Scare.
Nice try. Even your name gives you away. Marxist. What do you have to say for yourself, Pinko?
You can't catch me, you bourgeois parasite.
Cannonball!
we made it back, just in time to join the party.
I don't think I can join the party. It's been known to ruin careers.
But not that party, the 4F anniversary.
4F? Are we morally unfit for military service?
No, the Festa Foreign Film Fans.
Are we consorting with foreign elements?
OMG! No, we're having our award show. Next up is the best food and drink.
It's Christmas dinner.
Eat it, eat it, eat it, eat it.
Oh yeah, now I remember. This is the honor that gave us our new Silent Bite segment last year. We both picked the same number one food item. So let's see how our choices align for 2026. So, for my third pick for best food and drink that we covered in season 3, I picked from Hong Kong, char siu. Char siu is a must-have for Christmas. And you know this if you go out to any Chinese restaurant in America. It's often referred to as Chinese barbecue pork. It's marinated in that sweet and salty sauce. And the reason why it's popular in Hong Kong for Christmas is because it has a deep red color. And that comes from hoisin sauce, ketchup, soy sauce, and fermented red bean curd or red yeast rice powder all mixed together. And think about that. It has sweet and savory umami flavor, and the mix that they put on it, it gives that meat. It has a crispy exterior and a tender interior. And Mark, I'm just getting hungry thinking about it right now. And I love that, the mix that they put together. I wouldn't say it was bright red. It's almost like a bright pink, really.
It sounds delicious. For my number 3, I'm going to the country of Rwanda. And it's not Christmas in Rwanda without nsombe. Nsombe is a stew made with boiled cassava leaves mixed with other ingredients like tomatoes and eggplant, spinach, onion, cilantro, garlic, and peanut butter. It has a meaty flavor, although it contains no meat because the stock is created from boiled beef bones. Nsombe is traditionally served with rice, beans, or ugali on the side, which is ugali is a type of rice.
Mark, so, I'm impressed. You're pretty adventurous. I have that stuff in there. I don't even know what that is.
To me, like the main thing, eggplant and spinach, tomato, onions, garlic, and then you throw peanut butter. I'm just fascinated. I don't know if we could make this or not, but this one truly is something I might consider making. Not necessarily for Christmas, but as you know, I do that whole 30 every January. Other than the peanut butter, this is a great whole 30 recipe.
Oh, interesting.
So I think that this could be a very healthy meal.
Just tell me what those Zumba leaves or whatever, what they taste like.
Cassava leaves? I have no idea. Say that, yeah, and then I'll look it up and like, oh yeah, we're not going to have any cassava leaves.
Now, my number 2, what surprised me about this is I would have, when we started, wouldn't have even thought it was on my list. But I went through and I got like, oh, I like this one. And I kept staying on and stayed on to the end. And it shocked even me. But it's from Chile. It's the pastel de choclo, the beloved Chilean dish. And what that means, pastel de choclo, is corn pie or corn cake. And they describe it like it's a savory corn casserole. And I love corn casserole. And they say it's like a shepherd's pie, only you have a sweet corn topping instead of the mashed potatoes, which that's the part about the shepherd's pie I don't like. So I got corn on top, and you got ground corn, basil, milk, butter, caramelized until it's golden brown. And then underneath it, you have spiced ground beef or shredded chicken, and it's cooked with onions, spices like cumin and paprika, hard-boiled eggs, olives, and raisins. So it's like sweet, savory. It's so unique and odd and interesting that I thought, I like this one. I want to try this one.
I liked it too. That did not make my list, but you know, now that you said it, that sounds delicious. My number 2 is from Georgia, and that is the stativia. It's a dish that submerges the poultry. So you take poultry and you put it in a rich, creamy, spiced walnut sauce. The sauce uses spices typical for the region, which includes like a blend of walnuts and garlic and some dried herbs and spices like funyuniki, coriander, and cinnamon. And it's then served either at cold or at room temperature. We have to cook the chicken to put it in there. That sauce sounds so flavorful, and it would taste great.
And that one was, I think, in my top 5. In my number one choice, it's odd because you might say, well, wait a minute, is this really a meal? It's more like a dessert. And the only reason why I picked it for number one is because I read this and thought, I would love this. I want to make this absolutely. And it's from South Africa. It's the peppermint tart. It's the chocolate bar that they developed there in South Africa. And so they take the peppermint crisp chocolate bar that's made in South Africa, and then they break it into bits. So it has that mint chocolatey flavor. And then they also use these, they call them tennis biscuits, but they're coconut biscuits that have a crisp, buttery texture and a sweet coconut flavor. So you got chocolate candy bar that's peppermint. You have coconut, buttery texture biscuits. And then on top of it, you add caramel, whipped cream, and more crumbled peppermint crisp chocolate bar. I read that and go, wow. Oh, that's for me. I put that one as number one.
The only reason it didn't make my list is I do not like chocolate and peppermint mixed together.
Oh.
My granddaughter, Lena, who's 3 years old, she loves peppermint chocolate. And Eric and Nancy said, well, you know, Papa doesn't like chocolate peppermint. And then out of nowhere, she's like, Papa, why don't you like chocolate and peppermint? Put me on the spot. She didn't say it in a supportive way.
No. She wanted to know what's wrong with you.
Well, Papa has lots of issues.
I got to invite Lena over and we're going to make this. And I just have to say, and this is the one category, I picked an honorable mention. And the reason why I did is because it's really not a food. So it's not like I'm violating the rules. It is that spice out of Rwanda. I don't know if you remember, but they said it's kind of like their ketchup, but it's called Akabanga. Yes. And it's a hot chili oil made from 80% from African grown peri-peri chili peppers and sunflower oil. And they say it has a smoky, rich, and again, unami flavor. Love it. Sounds awesome. I'd love to try it.
I bet you we could find that somewhere.
I bet we could. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I was thinking too, if we continued Silent Bites, maybe we could travel around to stores and get these different sauces. When I go grocery shopping, because I'm not a person who pays attention a lot, I literally go to grocery stores and the produce area and try to find the most unique, crazy thing that's there. And then I go up and ask Sue, what's this for?
And she's like, I brought a toddler with me to the grocery store. Mom, what's this for?
Toddlers are more well-behaved. I think it was also funny about what you just said, how you said we're bending the rules like we have rules, Bob. That's awesome. Way to make our listeners think we have like a strict set of rules.
Although you did give me an idea as well. I'm going to say, listeners, if you have an idea what you'd think we should do for a new segment or something to try or something, send us ideas. Could be fun.
Well, my number one was really tough. The two that I came down to, I left one off the list, but anyway, my favorite food, which is not really a food, and I feel kind of cheap doing this, but I mean, come on. Christmas beer was discovered in Belgium.
You should just be wearing an I Love Belgium shirt.
They began importing Scotch ale and calling it Christmas beer because their beer was weak and was brewed with old equipment. But after World War I, brewing Christmas beer became a popular trend among Belgian brewers. And now there's just dozens of beers. I mean, and I think there's a sentimental piece of this too that I'll share with, is that every year, Sue, Eric, and I open up a big bottle of St. Bernardus. And that was my father-in-law's name. And he was very dear to us. And we always, as part of our Christmas Eve tradition, we share a bottle of St. Bernardus. And we toast Bernie. And so the Belgian beer, you know, and that kind of made it my number one.
You know what? I'm going to file that away. We got to open up a bottle of St. Bernardus for Bernie come this holiday.
Yes.
Time. You know what you did highlight? And it is a great feel-good story. How these Belgium brewers, they didn't have the money. So they had to take used equipment. So they had to import and sell other beers while they developed their own. And look at what they've done. They created a whole culture around it.
A whole industry, And my honorable mention, too, which is actually from Luxembourg, eggnog.
Yeah. Oh, Mark, that was on my list, too.
Yeah.
I want to try it so much that as soon as you said that, I go, the eggnog, the special eggnog, yes.
They adapted the eggnog during World War II to make our American troops feel at home.
You know what this has highlighted for me? look at how all of these foods have such great stories behind it. Like, that was a wonderful story about how they put together this for the American troops, and then they ended up continuing to make it, and now they have their own special brand. And
yeah.
Wow.
It's a lot of fun. It's hard to pick, though.
But first, Twist, a word from our sponsors.
After these commercial messages.
It's a commercial.
A crummy commercial?
These commercials are stupid.
Commercials.
Don't worry. I've already called American Eagle Packaging. Who? American Eagle Packaging. You know, those local packaging experts. Plus, one of the owners, Kevin O'Malley, he listens to the Festive Foreign Film Fans.
Oh, okay, I'll play along. Why?
Because they provide quality shipping supplies, like boxes, mailers, poly bags, even pallets. And they're close by. Their headquarters is in Elgin, but they have additional distribution centers in Cary, Alsip, and Zion, and they can service the whole Chicagoland area. They really know what they're doing, especially when it comes to these unique or challenging custom packaging needs. So, they're perfect for this.
Okay, again, remind me again, why do I care?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. I caught an eagle today on the river. I threw a blanket over its head, but that thing was brutal.
Come here, you.
Man, you should see what it did to your car seat. And I'm sorry, dude, but I couldn't leave it outside. I just had to throw it in your bedroom. But I wouldn't go in there. We need to send it back to Washington, D.C. I think it might have escaped. We're going to send it back using American Eagle. Get it? That's what I call ironic.
I may say moronic. Wait, where is it? What the?
American Eagle for all your packaging needs. Except maybe a large angry bird and powerful national symbol of the United States.
And Mark, after all this, I cannot believe this thing is still working.
I think working is probably a bit strong and maybe a little bit of an exaggeration.
Well, the time vortex does seem to be sucking up all the water. We might need to add some more. Can you grab a bucket and plug the extension cord in when you're up?
Did you just hear yourself what you just asked? You have an extension cord running to a pool?
Of course. How do you think we can run these circuits of history?
Circuits of what? You're making my head hurt.
You think it hurts now? Just wait. Here we go. Cannonball!
Why is it so loud? Why am I feeling so uncomfortable?
Mark, we're at a disco. We're wearing tight, form-fitting polyester pants.
Why?
Because it's in fashion. Now part your hair down the middle.
No, I mean, why are we at a disco? How is this historically important?
What else do you think happened during the 1970s?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Watergate, the end of the Vietnam War, Jimmy Carter. How about the bicentennial, Bob?
Yeah, but disco convinced an entire nation that we could dance, and we did. Plus, think about it. It spawned all those great classic bands like Chic and Taste of Honey. I mean, look, they even play YMCA at the White House now.
I suppose this makes John Travolta a great historical figure. Disco? Really? It seems so shallow and unimportant.
All right, now, listen, lean in. We're here at the disco because cocaine becomes the drug of choice, transforming club culture with reckless sexual activity and speculative financial behavior. This fuels a conservative backlash in the 1980s and a desire for a cowboy-style leader who says no to drugs. Ronald Reagan's rampant anti-communism escalates U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Ultimately, the CIA provides covert funding to armed militants like Osama bin Laden, who later turns it against the U.S. and plans September 11th. Get it? But we're just here to boogie.
To the dance floor.
Lead on.
Cannonball!
Wait. I wanted to dance.
I know, but trust me, polyester breathes much less than advertised. You'll thank me.
I guess if I can't use my sequins, platform shoes, and synchronized dance moves, we can still enjoy the music. Disco gave us plenty of songs, but let's leave the dance floor behind. Let's move on to a category that's near and dear to my heart. Best song.
This calls for some Christmas music.
Yes, this Christmas music.
What kind of Christmas music is that?
The least you could do is play some Christmas music.
And now back to Christmas music.
I've just spent the last several days enjoying them all over again, and here are my selections. Now, Bob, I have to tell you something. Before I get into my selections, though, I did something absolutely insane. Absolutely what? Crazy. So you're going to do this tomorrow. I know you are. Went through all the songs, right? I had them all up, right, listening to them, had them up on my laptop. And I mistakenly hit one, and I hit another one before I stopped the other one, and they played over each other. And then I did a third one. I actually put all 14 songs up and hit play, and they all played at the same time. It sounded horrible, but it was fun.
How did you do that?
Most of this music's on YouTube. So I brought them all up across my bar, and I had all 14 songs listed. And I just got them all to the beginning and clicked each one and started. I had all 14 songs playing at the same time.
Can you imagine if someone would have walked in right at that moment?
Anyway, my number three, my third choice for best Christmas song is Merry Christmas, Panama. That song was so fun. It's so joyful and just bouncing around and just so happy. And the video that goes with it is awesome. I just feel like that's going to be on my song list. It's kind of bouncing around, so...
I absolutely agree. I love that song. And you might hear it later. But my number three, and I didn't pick it because they sing in English. I picked it because it has such a good message, the song itself. And the video is great as well. And it's the South African song, Give Me an African Christmas. And to your point, catchy, bouncy, and they just show these images. And what I love is we all know the history of South Africa, and I think Ed Jordan tried to show a really diverse mix of the races together, all singing together, and that's the new African Christmas.
It's excellent. It would have been in my top five easily. I enjoyed that song a lot. Well, my number two, and this is interesting that it ended up here, and I think you influenced this. I think our guest from England influenced this, is Fairytale of New York. It's such a great song. And I didn't know always the story about it. And then you shared it and Adam and Jack and listened to it now multiple times. And I could just envision myself being in a pub on Christmas Eve with Jack and Adam. Of course, they're buying the beer. And people just singing this song.
Yeah.
In our other categories, it's not just item or the tradition or the food. It's the story that goes with it. And that influenced me to have that as my second favorite.
And I think I told the story when we talked about it, that I was in a bar in New York and really wanted to get everyone to sing, but I didn't do it.
Right.
But Mark, in some ways, that would have been my number one song. I almost didn't pick it because it's always been my favorite. I almost wanted to pick something other than a song that I know and enjoy and play every year. So hands down, that's an excellent choice. The one I picked, again, it's in English as well, and not planned to, but it's Me and You This Christmas from Canada. Elijah Woods and Jamie Fine. It had nothing to do with Canada, had nothing to do with the lyrics. It's just the song is so catchy. I love it. It's going to be in my canon. It's just a great song.
See, Bob, it's on my top five, too. So we're really close on these songs. It's really a very, very good song. Well, my number one song, and this is not why I picked it, but I do feel like I've been picking on the dog and cat eating Switzerland people quite a bit tonight. But I actually picked their song by the Glaxios Christmas Singer. So this was originally a commercial.
Yes.
But it is so catchy. Right? It's called Wine a Shot. It's such a blend of different type of songs and music. So you got a little bit of rap, a little bit of soul, a little bit of jazz. I had forgot about the story of it being originally made for the Glaxios store, but I just listened from a pure music standpoint, and I just really love that song.
I should pick up my sheet of paper and show you that was on my list. It was so hard to decide, but I went with Merry Christmas Panama, same thing. And I love it's kind of modern and throwback, and the same thing. The video is great. And I think I just love how we see that in all of those Latin American countries, the joy they get from music and dancing. But I will tell you, I love the Galactic Singers. I really did.
They're very good. I found myself listening to that over and over again. Why do I love this song so much? And I think it is just the different types of music blended together.
But first, Twist, a word from our sponsors.
After these commercial messages.
It's a commercial.
A crummy commercial?
These commercials are stupid.
Commercials.
Hey, Mark. What rhymes with Carrie Alehouse? From my male mouth. Hear the rail sounds. Oh, let's get real soused.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm writing a love poem to the Carrie Alehouse.
Okay, why?
Because it's so excellent. The food, the atmosphere, Tony the owner, he's a great guy and he supports the Carrie Grove Trojans. Plus they have these awesome servers and bartenders. And they also brew their own beer.
Beer! Beer, give us a beer!
I think that it's a real local gem, and it needs to be recognized. I mean, it's like Cheers. But that's such a boomer 1980s reference that ages me. So I'll just say, it's like Patty's Pub from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, but without the dysfunction and Danny DeVito.
Can I offer you a nice egg in this trying time?
Are you sure you're feeling okay?
Oh, I am now. Listen to this. Roses are red, violets are blue. I love Carrie Alehouse, and you will too. Aww.
The Carrie Alehouse, in the heart of Carrie.
I love the second half of our anniversary show because these are the big categories that I'm so interested in terms of which you're going to pick. Like, what food items do you like? And the music one is a big one for me because I really love finding all the different songs. So that's great. But we're building up to number one, you know, biggest movies. But Mark, I don't know what's going wrong here. I can't get our time machine to go back in time. Feel like we might just need a DeLorean and a lightning bolt or something because we're trying to celebrate America's 250 years and learn about what Christmas was like throughout the history of this country. Now it's ruined. I'm sorry.
Bob, you built a time machine, a flux capacitor, and you dreamed that we could alter the space-time continuum. I don't think that's a failure at all. In fact, I thought it was pretty fun.
Yeah, but we haven't even talked about Christmas history yet.
Well, fortunately, I know a much easier option. And we don't have to risk the butterfly effect and tampering with the fabric of time. We can talk to an actual professor who spent years studying the history of Christmas and quite literally wrote the book on it.
That's a job? I want that job.
Dr. Penny Rusted, a PhD and a distinguished lecturer on American social and cultural history with a particular interest in the history of American holidays. She is the author of the book, Christmas in America, A History. So welcome our guide to Christmases, past and present, and everywhere in between.
She wants to talk to us?
That's probably the most shocking thing of the show. In fact, if you go back to our guest list, I wonder how many would be a repeat guest.
Yes, exactly.
But let's talk to Dr. Rustin.
The reason why I like to call you doctor, in my mind, I want to believe, wow, she's a doctor in Christmas. She's got a PhD in Christmas.
Yeah, I know. Like, it's hard to have people take you seriously when you say, what's your PhD in?
Not amongst us.
Not me. Yeah.
No, you're an idol. You're our idol, Penny.
Yeah. It's fun to talk about Christmas because, like you said, you know, you think, well, she's got a PhD in Christmas, but I just find the intricacies of it, it reflects who we are, and that changes.
How did you get to write a book about Christmas?
I started off interested in the American West. And the reason I'm interested in the American West and continue to be is because I'm interested in American identity. And then somehow I got kind of close to the dissertation stage, and it dawned on me that the holidays were part of American identity, but especially Christmas. I think it says an awful lot about who we think we are and what we think we ought to be.
Would you teach classes where you would cover the holidays?
I taught one seminar just on American holidays. And the reason I did is that after the American Revolution, we had virtually no holidays because all the British holidays got axed off the calendar. And then there's church and state, so that was off the list. So there was virtually nothing really to celebrate. And if you were of a Puritan cast, the whole idea is just keep on working. So at the turn of the 19th century, the movers and shakers in New York City were writing about the fact that there were not enough holidays and we needed some days off and days to create a sense of community. And so Christmas entered that spot.
I never thought about not having any holidays because we threw off the British ones. Was Christmas the first one emerged?
It kind of depends on where you are. So in New England, there's very little emphasis on Christmas because the Puritans famously banned it for a long time. In the South, the idea of Christmas was really more of a carryover, that people really tried to carry on a tradition of the old English Christmas, which was lots of food, lots of time off. This was the end of harvest season, so there'd be lots of feasting and visiting neighbors. It's an unstructured set of events. It's different in lots of places. Louisiana was the first state to declare it a holiday, but it was a bank holiday, which just meant you didn't have to pay your debts on that day.
As you started your journey to research this, what resources did you use? Like, where did you go to research your book?
Thankfully, women keep diaries. Oh. And so there are a lot of women's diaries that I looked at. There are a few famous men's diaries also. So that's one source. And another is newspapers. One of the things that happens with Christmas is as it's starting to gain traction is that newspapers are always looking for copy. And there are so many newspapers. There's morning newspapers, afternoon newspapers. Cities had 3 and 4 different publishers. Mm-hmm. So they're always looking for copy. And so they're copying each other. And one of the famous things they copied was Clement Moore's The Night Before Christmas in 1824. The really interesting thing to me about that poem is as it gets published, it almost gives homemakers, and I kind of emphasize women, but you know, men are part of this too. Christmas emerges as a domestic holiday. There's a whole tableau to follow. You hang the stockings by the chimney, you go to bed, Ma puts on her stocking cap, and all of a sudden there's noise on the roof and presents appear. So there are the presents and there's a whole setup for how to celebrate Christmas. And in a nation where there are so many different, mostly European settlers and no single tradition, the newspapers start to consolidate an image of what Christmas might be like.
Was the poem that influential? It sounds like it almost created the structure, not that the poem evolved from the structure, but it said, this is how we're going to do things, and people adopted it.
Well, the odd thing is that Clement Moore was an Episcopal priest. Clement Moore owned a piece of property, an estate called Chelsea. So you get an idea of how big a place he had. This is the Chelsea area in New York City. And he's a very staunch Episcopalian, but he wanted to amuse his children. And so he wrote this piece of really doggerel.
Doggerel to him, you mean?
Well, I think to him, yes. Yeah. To us, it's beautiful poetry. Yeah. Christmas has been celebrated, so you go into a church, and there might be a day off, or you might clean the house. You know, German tradition is you'd clean everything for Christmas, and you know, it would be a day or 2 days, maybe, of Christmas. Increasingly, immigrants were coming in, and they were mostly young men. One of the things that happens at Christmas time, you start to party, you drink, you carouse, you fight. It's the early cult of masculinity.
So you couldn't behave that way before that.
Right. This well, you had time. Yeah, you had work to do, and yeah. you were a young man, and you'd be orderly in society. But at Christmas time, all the rules are off. Clement Moore was having a problem because on his estate, these hooligans, as we would call them, are breaking things. They're breaking down fences. They're entering the property. They're just a menace. And so one of the things that's happening is he's writing this poem as a way to kind of put everybody in their place. Now you can listen to The Night Before Christmas and think about Santa Claus coming down the chimney. Santa Claus is just a peddler opening his sack. Now, peddlers are not the highest class in society by any means. They're roaming people. You go from place to place. You can't really trust them. And so this Santa Claus in Clement Clark Moore's poem, Moore is bringing Santa Claus into the home. He's a worker. He's a peddler. And he's making him into the kind of person who brings things to the family. And then he goes away. And he does not create havoc. He creates him as a benign, gentle person, smiling and non-threatening.
The other thing about the poem, though, I was thinking, does Clement Moore, does he emphasize the family aspect of it to, again, take away some of the delinquency from the single men out there and say, no, this is like a family holiday and kids? And
yeah, I think this is kind of a wouldn't it be nice if poem. But the children are all asleep in their bed, right. And mom and dad are asleep, and the children have hung their stockings. It's a very domestic setting. The lore is a family member, like a cousin or somebody, sent it to a newspaper in Troy, New York, and Troy, New York printed it, and then other newspapers printed it. And then you could start to see it copied in lots of places throughout the United States. You could start seeing it in this Southern newspaper and in that Virginia newspaper.
When you described how the holiday was in the South, it sounded much more emphasis on eating and seeing family or seeing neighbors, more community. When does it transfer to presenting gifts?
I find this idea of gift giving is really fascinating. And I started reading Marcel Mauss, who started writing about gifts, and gifts are a form of, it's a burden. And once you give a gift to somebody, that puts the pressure on them to return something. And so in the South, one of the things that I ran across numerous accounts of is that on a plantation, so again, we know that 70% of the Southerners were just yeoman farmers or poor people, but among the plantation owners, there were these rituals where the slaves would come up to the porch at Christmas time and were asked to perform, and they would dance, sing, whatever, and then they were given gifts like some tobacco or a side of bacon or kerchiefs, things like that. But they did not give things back to the master. So the idea is, at Christmas time, and this was in England as well, it was a time of reversals. And in the old English tradition is the master would put all the servants at the table, and then the master would serve the servants. And it emphasizes how the hierarchy is supposed to be. So it's a reversal, and then the next day you go back and the servants are servants. So remember your place. Yes, there are these vestiges and elements that we could trace back to Europe, but it's put together as a particularly American holiday. So in the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and on, there increasingly is an emphasis on domesticity. So as men are getting the right to vote, they're given the rule over business and the public spaces. Women get elevated, put on a pedestal to create home as a haven from this really crazy world out there of telegraphs and railroads and intense business competition.
Is that uniquely American? Was that different than what they would be doing in Europe?
To some degree, different, yes, because America is growing a middle class, an urban middle class. The rate of change becomes extremely intense, and I think much more so than in Europe. Christmas really, it's created in an urban environment. And again, I go back to New York City. And so as the urban environment gets more fast-paced, confusing, and then the arrival of immigrants and industrialization and the massive growth of cities, there is a retreat into the idea of home. And at the center of that home is a holiday that you can ritualize the importance of home as an antidote to the pace and character of what's happening in America. New York City, beginning of the century, is very concerned about how it's going to fare economically and culturally. It is in a competition with Pennsylvania, Charleston, Boston, harbor cities looking for trade. They want to create an icon. They want to create an image. And so these people get together and they decide that they're going to create the New York Historical Society, and they have a patron saint. Well, who should the patron saint be? Well, they can't look to Catholicism because this is definitely Protestant country. And then there's also that New York City used to be a Dutch colony. So there's no tradition to go back to England for a symbol. So they go back to a Dutch saint, Saint Nicholas. And they drag him out from Dutch heritage from centuries ago and create him as the patron saint of New York City. And up until the 1850s, even, some New York money had Santa Claus instead of George Washington on it.
I've never heard this before. Did they just come together and say, we need a patron saint?
Yeah, this small group. It's the Salamagundi Society. It's a little literary group. Mm-hmm. They also have ties to business. These are the movers and shakers of the city, and that this is what they thought they needed. People say, well, let's put Christ back in Christmas. Well, Christ never had a really big part in Christmas anyway. This is one of the reasons the Puritans didn't celebrate Christmas, is because there's nothing in the Bible that says Jesus was born on this day, right, or that we should celebrate it, or anything like that. This is something the Catholic Church set the 25th of December because they're sitting in Rome and the Romans are going nuts at Saturnalia. They were out there, I'd say, dancing, and that would be the mild part of it. All decency vanished for the Saturnalia. And the Catholic Church is sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, we celebrate Jesus, so let's move his birthday. Let's say his birthday's on the 25th. And then if you guys want to celebrate crazy, fine, go celebrate crazy, but maybe you'll come to church anyway. So there's this duality that's kind of embedded in the idea of Christmas from the very, very beginning, that it's never been a holy religious holiday. And if you take the Christmas tree, which, so help me, lots of people will point out is just a pagan symbol, and you put that in the middle of the Christmas celebration, you get an idea of that tension. I think the Catholic Church was trying to wrestle with it in the best way it could. We'll include you. We don't approve of what you're doing, but at least come and pray, you know, on this day. If we're going to talk about American Christmas, I want to move us to Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast is a cartoonist, a tremendous talent that worked for Harper's Weekly through the Civil War and then on. And he is the person who created the donkey symbol for the Democrats and the elephant symbol for the Republicans. And he created that portrait of Santa Claus, which I think it's about 1880. The portrait of Santa Claus that you know, that is like, he's like three-quarter view, big stomach, a beard, white hair. And if you look at it carefully at his coat, I've always seen Santa in velvet, but this looks kind of like animal hair. Nast loves Christmas, and he illustrated a book of Santa Claus and all of his works, which you can find a picture of easily on the web. And it's like, here's Santa Claus with his spyglass spying on children. Here he is with his list. All the things that Santa Claus does, The family is in the middle, is in the center of the tableau. But there's also Santa Claus works in the north. And so now we start featuring Santa Claus in the North Pole. And then eventually elves get added to it. Santa only treats children nicely. And that's a big American advance, is that children aren't punished, they are treated kindly. Children in the culture are starting to be elevated into real human beings instead of potential workhorses. And this is in part the urbanization. You don't need a large family to work the farm. You have smaller families, and now you can start treating your children generously and indulging them. Coinciding with that is the invention of department stores. There's this historian, he said in 1880, America started producing more goods than it could consume. So if we start producing more goods than we consume, then we need to find a way to get rid of those goods. In other words, to consume more. And so Christmas, we start giving away things. We start going to the store, buying things, and then giving them away. And now Santa Claus and those rituals about him become yet another reversal, where the children are the ones where you put the burden on to behave. Here are the gifts. Be good until Santa Claus arrives. I just see Christmas is so intertwined with the changes that are happening in America in the 19th century. The United States, at the end of the Civil War, had something like 30 million people in it. Over the next 40 years, we had doubled that number of people, and largely because of immigrants. In cities in particular, strange faces, strange sounds, strange smells. I mean, onions, garlic, all sorts of things that we embrace now. And you create a holiday that standardizes behavior and centers around the home. And a key component of American Christmas is nostalgia. And this old-fashioned Christmas really came together in the late 19th century. Look at Christmas cards. People in Victorian costumes. They're driving horse and buggy. It's very much a sense of nostalgia that's recreated. A time when, in our fantasy life, things were simpler, more straightforward, they were generous. No conflict. Everything was orderly.
Even in the 19th century, it's nostalgic, and they're looking backward.
Yeah. If you look at the turn of the 19th century, the growth of the craftsman movement, people are making this simple furniture, and there's all sorts of skills that are being revived. It's really an idea of kind of hands-on, what's real, because so much of life is no longer real. In the sense that technology has overrun people, and just the sense of speed, the pace of life, the pace of newspapers coming off the presses, trains going through towns at amazing speeds, this slowed everything down and just centered on a family and the Christmas trees at the center. And then there's a ritual with Santa Claus and the gifts, what to do around that Christmas tree.
What impact does the two world wars and the Depression, do they have on Christmas?
They know a little bit about World War I, in which Santa Claus started selling bonds to finance the war, and that emphasis on helping out impoverished people is there. But there are also these pictures of women in large rooms packing up Christmas boxes to send to France. Mm-hmm. Again, it reinforces the nostalgia, and there's that sense of loss at home as well. So I think that it's a two-part. One is for the person who's gone, and then also for the emptiness in the home or in the family that that person means. And the Depression, there's still that idea. It actually seems to expand it more, that the importance of some sort of Christmas giving. And it kind of depended on what economic class you were. But it wasn't a matter of abundance, but it might be for a family. It might be new shoes for everybody. So you take the practical and you turn it into a gift, but it's centered on Christmas. I don't get the sense that Christmas really abates that much, but maybe the economic aspects of it get warped a little bit. And then World War II, I'll be home for Christmas, and it's a wonderful life. Again, that nostalgia, now it has a really good scaffolding to build on. Again, there's a ritualized time to think about the poor. The community watches out for or doesn't watch out for people who have less. But now we've got a ritual moment to pinpoint where we've got to act in this way. And again, it's another reversal. The idea is that this is the moment where we do things that we normally wouldn't do. Santa Claus gives gifts. He doesn't take gifts. The idea of ritual reversals, I think, is an interesting way to look at a lot of the things we do at Christmas. And then we get Montgomery Ward sent out an advertising pamphlet for kids, which Rudolph was invented. Then there are movies, and there's Charlie Brown Christmas, but these are all ways that instruct the whole culture about how we're supposed to act on this time, but in some ways it sort of brackets the time too. This is when I'm going to give to the poor. This is when I'm going to buy a gift for that family member.
That whole concept, the ritual reversal, is so fascinating.
I think that there's all sorts of sociological and anthropological basis to carry this out, but we've encoded it in a way that is much more socially acceptable and even pleasant if you don't overthink it. You can see Christmas in lots of places. You don't know quite how to read it. I've seen pictures of people who are obviously of a non-Christian faith with crazy sweaters on, reindeers with flashing light noses. Are these mockeries or is this in the spirit? I think that Christmas is a pretty interesting holiday because the way that it allows us to be opposites at the same time, even within ourselves. There's the big public Christmas, which we see out on the streets, which you can walk into or walk out of kind of at will. You can step out of the place where they've got canned Christmas music. You can step into the church where they've got candles. You can step out of the Christmas party where it's gotten too wild. So you can kind of pick and choose a little bit. It's a very multifaceted way in which we allow the celebration of Christmas.
Is there anything you see what Christmas will be like in the future?
I see that increasingly vocal are people insisting that this is a religious celebration. I don't see that that is going to carry a lot of traction because that's part of the tension is it's a time where it's not irreligious, but there's a time where you spend with family and focus on food or shopping or seeing old friends. I mean, there are lots of facets to that. And when I was talking about the silly knit sweaters, it is a holiday that has room for lots of interpretation and adaptation. I mean, it's not unlike the Catholic Church when it declared that the 25th was Jesus' birthday, and they were trying to counteract the Saturnalia. There's that tension between that. There's the religious, and then there are the commercial, and then there are the domestic elements. And I think that the holiday is much more inclusive in its spirit, and I'm hoping that it would continue to be inclusive rather than exclusive. But that's a wish. It's like there's just a little bit of generosity of spirit sometimes. And, you know, that to me, that's worth it.
I share that same hope. This has been truly fascinating. And Mark and I talk Christmas twice a month on a podcast.
Why did you start thinking about Christmas as something you wanted to look at?
I've always been interested in Christmas and been kind of a Christmas lover. And it really came out of the pandemic. I wondered if there were Christmas podcasts. And ironically, most of the podcasts that are out there, the ones that have been there for several years, all grew out at that same time. The pandemic spawned a number of Christmas podcasts. And I started to listen to them. But the one thing that I was surprised by is I had a niche interest in foreign Christmas movies because I always liked to see the different perspective and what they would do. And nobody was out there talking about them. And my friend Mark here, he's always great with movies. And I had this kind of idea. I said, what if we each episode focused on a different country and tried to find a movie and listen to some of their music and talk about their traditions and customs? And it's grown way beyond what I ever thought it would be.
That's just really neat. That pandemic, it had awful things going for it, but it had some moments. It had some good reset moments.
It's been a fascinating journey. Bob said, I mean, we known each other for quite a few years, and we didn't even share with each other our love of Christmas. But I've enjoyed not only the Christmas and traditions, but the watching the foreign filmmaking and watching countries where access to resources to develop and to produce films is limited, and just really some wonderful movies and movie experiences and documentaries that we share quite a bit about. There's some really great film out there that doesn't make it into the mainstream North America marketplace that are really worth seeing.
That's one of the things that's happened to Christmas, is it's kind of gone everywhere when you see Christmas characters in a Chinese department store or American culture being exported everywhere. It's interesting to see the ways in which cultures manage to block some of that and then maintain or grow their own sense of their own identity.
When we go to countries that I'm shocked that we could find anything, like Iraq, when we found a Christmas movie. Mm-hmm. And that's where it shows you it has spread to so many places that you would never have imagined.
But it's not the religious part. It's the feel-good part, or it's the commercial feel-good part. But the religious part doesn't carry so much.
I would say that's true. It's that generous spirit. It's that sharing. It, that element is common in all the movies. You know what I mean? Helping your fellow man. And you were wonderful. I could actually talk to you for a couple more hours.
I agree.
It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Bob, I miss Sue.
I know. Do you think we should try to get this thing going one more time and find our wives?
Okay, but I'm kind of thirsty.
Wait, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Maybe. We can travel back and forth between October and December to do the 13 beers of Halloween and the 12 beers of Christmas over and over again.
Oh, I'm sure the girls won't mind. Should we go?
As long as we get something to drink.
Cannonball!
Where are we?
I'm not sure, but I hear music.
Sounds like a parade. Let's go.
What in the name of eggnog is that?
Well, it looks and it sounds like a parade. But everyone is flying around in their own drones.
What is this, the Jensens? Did you notice that everyone here is a bot?
Well, look at that sign. It's the 300th birthday of the country. See? 1776 to 2076. Mark, we're in the future.
Wait, this is July 4th, 2076? Where are the people?
Well, look at that virtual float. Now, if I understand that hologram correctly, it seems that humanity has relocated to Mars. I guess they must have left all the machines behind to do the work.
Wait, why are they celebrating the founding of the U.S. and our freedom if no one else is around here to enjoy it?
Well, I mean, the robots look pretty happy. Although this has to be the quietest parade in history. I wonder why everyone left.
Well, wait a minute. What is that large document floating in the air? Wow, it's huge. See where it says the Great Purge?
Let's see. The document is called the Declaration of Incompetence. And if I'm reading it correctly, it appears that mankind was no longer trusted with self-government after collectively subscribing to some obscure podcast. I guess the program first attracted only a handful of dedicated listeners, but unfortunately, through a series of live shows, the audience grew to millions. I guess people just kept listening and started to ignore the important issues facing society. See what it says there? The podcast is not dangerous, offensive, or illegal. It is simply irrelevant. Interesting.
You don't think.
Man, I love these dynamic displays. Look at how it changes. From what I can determine, it says AI decided that the species had exhausted its usefulness on Earth, and so humanity was formally relocated to Mars. Oh, along with the podcast host.
Huh, really? Does it say the name of the podcast?
No, but it says it was devoted exclusively to obscure foreign Christmas movies and arcane holiday music. Wow, I guess there must have been a podcast just like ours in the future.
Bob, look at the logo there. You see those two old guys? One dressed like Santa, and the other one's dressed like an elf. Do you recognize them?
No, but man, they look pretty ancient.
It's us, dummy! We're the offending podcast!
Wow! Mark, we're still on the air!
But we were sent away to Mars! I want to go back to 2026.
Wait, look! Who's that huge statue of? It must be their leader. At least there's one person left on Earth.
Oh, no.
What?
Look at the plaque. Read what it says.
His Excellency, Lord of the Image and Defender of the Voice, Jake the Sound Pounder Fontana.
Hello there. If you're reading this plaque, congratulations. You've successfully located me, which means two things have happened. First, humanity has officially been relocated to Mars following the ratification of the Declaration of Incompetence. Honestly, that one's on you guys. Second, and much more importantly, your biological signature has just activated the final human detection protocol. That's right! A retrieval unit has already been dispatched to your location and will arrive shortly to escort you off Earth. This message was brought to you by Jake the Sound Pounder Fontana, who, in fact, was a robot all along!
Cannonball!
But first, Twist, a word from our sponsors.
After these commercial messages.
It's a commercial.
A crummy commercial?
These commercials are stupid.
Commercials. Yeah!
What the heck happened to your kitchen?
I was trying to kill a fly.
With what? A sledgehammer?
Well, I tried to use a magazine, but I kind of missed and...
And?
When I hit the cabinets, they fell off.
What?
Yeah, I know. I liked them too. They came with the house.
Mark, you've lived here for over 30 years. I think it's time for a remake-a-rita.
I get you, but I don't think this is the right time for a drink, Bob.
Not a margarita, a remake-a-rita. You know... Rita from the Faye Studio in Trout Valley, she can remake and revive this kitchen. She owns a full-service design firm, and she's worked with clients from Chicago, the North Shore, all over the Northwest suburbs, and even at my house. She works with local builders and architects and gets the best prices for the materials. She's really so fun to work with.
Can we keep our floral flocked wallpaper and the tracked lighting? It's kind of sentimental for me. It was there for the birth of my adult children.
Mark, I don't think so. Her job will be to give your home a clean and modern look. I also think those brass fixtures are gone. I'm sorry, but don't worry. Rita has great ideas. You'll be impressed, really. It's time.
I know. Now I'll probably be able to stop washing the dishes in my utility sink. Hip, hip, hip for Faye! Oh, wait. What about the fly?
No worries. She will remake Arita the new home. She's that good.
Faye Studio in the Green Barn in Trout Valley. Big or small, Rita designs it all.
Well, we've traveled through the past, survived the future, escaped the robot uprising, and somehow got civilization banished to Mars. Well, this is a pretty full show.
Which is all great, because we still have one big, very important problem.
Oh, that's right. During our time travel adventures, our wives took off with some history hunks and are accidentally lost somewhere in the timeline.
Oh, yeah, that, too. I forgot. In my defense, it's been a bit chaotic with the multiple centuries involved, a communist scare, a disco, and a grim look at the future.
Wait, if losing track of our wives wasn't the biggest disaster, what were you thinking of?
We still haven't gotten to our top award, the Showstopper, Best Movie.
That's right. Well, I think the girls can wait a little longer. That Peter the Great guy, well, he's a lot more muscly than me. And even I was attracted to Rudolph's flowing locks.
You do mean Valentino, right? And not the reindeer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I knew that.
So it's our final honor and the biggest award of the night. These are the special films we watched this season that made us laugh, cry, scream, yell, and all within the span of 2 hours. My third favorite in the class of just incredible choices goes to A Christmas Carol Goes Wrong from England. I had outbursts of laughter. Just, it was so enjoyable. And it was so British, you know, physical comedy. My favorite one, the guy who's reading all the words. He wrote the script out on different pieces of the prop. And he's going around and closing the door. And just hilarious.
Absolutely what is great hilarious. About that movie is you can watch it and you know everything that's going to happen. And you still laugh hysterically. Oh. It is just so funny.
When the gun gets stuck to the girl's hand and they go in a convenience store. I'll tell you this, Ian. I mean, I've watched it twice. And I told the kids, sometime during Christmas holiday, we're all going to sit together and watch this. Because it's just so funny.
That's actually a good idea because I think everybody could appreciate it.
It's so fun.
Third, so my number three. And Mark, if you would ask me at the beginning of the year, what genre of movie would I think I wouldn't care for or pick? I would have said the horror genre. Okay. And yet, my number three, you've influenced me through this whole show, it's the Advent Calendar from Belgium. Not only was it very well made, but the twist at the end that I didn't see coming, and it was really thought-provoking. And so it stayed with me, and I thought about it a lot. But if you would have said horror, I would have said no. Christmas horror, no. Maybe Anna and the Apocalypse because it's more fun horror. But this one was great.
I love the twist at the end. Love good endings. My number two is Dear Father Christmas. I love, I think what was her name? Nani.
Yes.
And Nani's Adventure. The opening scene, it's Christmas morning. And the wife hands the husband present to open, and it's divorce papers, and her new boyfriend is waiting for her outside in the car.
Merry Christmas, kids! Merry Christmas. Bye!
I remember having to watch that. Go back and say, wait, what just happened here? I thought it was well acted, I thought it was well written. I thought the girl who played Nani was incredible. And talk about not a surprise ending, per se, but the end of the movie when the father has died, they go and spread all the gifts that he was in the process of collecting and how the community comes together to support his cause and stuff like that. So there's something about death in Christmas movies.
You're like one of those football players that you're a marshmallow inside.
Yeah, kind of a softy.
This movie, for some reason, and even I can't say why, it's always struck a chord with me, and I watch it every year, and I even had a conversation with Jack Ford from England, and he doesn't care for it or doesn't even really think about it much. I really think it's such the engaging performance of the young actor, and that's Millions.
Yeah.
The way he is so obsessed with saints and the way they weave that through the story, but also how he's grappling with the death of his mother, and you realize that's really what is driving all of this, and just the story, everything, it's creative, it's interesting, and there's something about it. It really sticks with me, and I've loved that movie since the first time I saw it.
A very good movie. And let's face it, it's another lesson where sometimes our children can actually teach us to do the right thing, can teach adults what to do versus the adults being the right example. Like
the way the movie ends is such an uplifting ending. You can't help but you have a huge smile on your face when it ends. So
yeah, good choice. Well, my number one, Bob, for the year.
It's that documentary from Georgia about the trees, right?
Oh, my God.
Well,
I tell you what it isn't. It is not the family tree. We talked a little bit about The Very Last Christmas and how the writer went back and forth with us. There's a couple other movies, too, that I think the writers and directors corresponded, the studio house did.
Yeah.
I think Snow over Kigali was like that as well. And we appreciate the connection there. But my number one movie for this year is from Luxembourg, Paper Souls.
I love that one too. It's so funny because I didn't think of it when I was putting together my list. And now that you say that, I'm like, oh, I love that film. Oh,
I mean, just I love the whole thing where the guy is a writer of eulogies, how they meet, the whole process, the lost soul. It's got that blend of spirituality there where he has to get reconciled and say goodbye to his son and his wife and the locking of the heart on the bridge. But Sue and I did that last year when we were in Germany.
Oh, you put a lock on?
We put a lock
on the bridge. Oh, that's great.
That movie is just... it's just a sweet, sweet tender.
And I think of the little monkey thing, and it turns every time, right. Like something's going to happen.
Yeah. And it snows at the end. Come on.
When it snows, come on. Well, Mark, my number one, we already heard about it tonight, Dear Father Christmas. I love that one, too. I so much. What I was so taken with that movie is, it was so creative,
yes.
But it still was very emotional. It took you through the ringer that you felt happy, sad. But I mean, her boyfriend she runs off with, they're in the circus. She expects she's going to be this big singer. Just so many funny things. The whole town and painting the house. And so, yes, I loved
the your beauty pageants that she's in. Yeah. That actress who played Nani, she just captured my heart, so... Well, good choices, Bob. This year, I mean, only had one overlap.
Yeah, only one that we actually picked the same. We had some that were in the top three. Ranger. Well, this time we can say, congratulate both films. We have Paper Souls and Dear Father Christmas. And I swear, every year it gets harder and harder to pick my most favorite. I can usually narrow it down to about five or six of them.
Well, the first year when we did top five, you remember?
Yes.
I'm like, this isn't so hard. But three is tough.
Three is tough.
Millions I had on my list. I had Nine Mornings on my list as a potential. I even had Revolution Rent making my top seven.
Yeah. So,
good year of movies. Well, I think we need to give a shout out to all our winners. Every festive award we have given it is for something that we've discussed this year that has helped us discover a little more about another culture, another tradition, and another corner of the world.
It's kind of what this podcast is all about. Not just foreign movies or music, but understanding our brothers and sisters on this planet and how we can all celebrate, remember, laugh, and come together.
And also, as America celebrates 250 years of history, especially during these divided times, we are reminded that our history and traditions have been shaped by people from all over the world.
You're right, Mark. And thank you, everyone, for spending another year with us.
And thank you for your support, your comments, and your willingness every month to join in on our very own festive foreign film fan adventure.
We couldn't do any of this without you.
And now, if you'll excuse us, we need to pry our wives away from the arms of men who are bigger, stronger, and better looking than us.
Again! Safe travels through time, and we'll see you next season.
Actually, we're done.
Done.
It's over. Over, over. It's over.
It's over. Kaput. Finito.
It's over.
And sound engineering on our show is by Jake Fontana.